Well, it is good to be back with you here on Bluegrass Sunday, first Sunday in August. I've been away for several weeks now on vacation, and I told you before I went that part of our time away as a family was going to be in Carolina Beach, so this is kind of your TripAdvisor report this morning. So we had a great time away. We had nice accommodations where we stayed. There was easy access to the beach. There were some attractions that we could enjoy. There was the boardwalk. There were hiking trails. There was an aquarium nearby. Of course, there was exceptional food throughout our time away, way too much of it. So we had a great time away together as a family. The only downside that I would report from that particular trip is just the long, seemingly forever drive to get there and back. So about 10 hours on the road if you factor in stops. So you really lose a day on either side as you're traveling. So some of you are travel people, and so you've had to make trips like that. Some of you are not travel people, and yet you still, to humor family or whatever, you're willing to go along. But you maybe wonder sometimes, what is it that makes a trip like that worthwhile? I mean, why do you take all of that time to fly or to drive or however you travel? What makes it worthwhile? And of course, no matter your bent toward traveling, there's motivation for you. If you're one of those that likes to go, well, hey, you think about what's coming, you anticipate the fun, and that makes it worthwhile to travel however long you have to travel. If you don't like to travel, well, you have to come home, don't you? And so, I mean, there's motivation to get home at the end of a long trip. So that gives us kind of a bit of a metaphor for the Christian life. Maybe it's cliche, but we could think about life with God as a long journey. And a question that we've been considering over the last number of weeks in this series that we've been in is, what is it that can motivate us to be faithful over the long haul? What can keep us walking with God for a whole lifetime? And our guide, as we've been considering these kinds of questions, has been the Old Testament book of Daniel. This is week 6 of our series, The Faithful Resistance, where we've been looking at Daniel and three of his friends who were carried away from their homes into exile as teenagers, carried from Israel to Babylon. And they faced the challenge in that very foreign culture, whether they should or how they could remain faithful to the God of Israel when they were far from home. Well, as we continue the series this morning, we've kind of turned the corner. If you know the book of Daniel at all, if you grew up in Sunday school, then we've kind of gotten, today we get past the parts of Daniel that you know, the fun stories that, you know, with flannel graph or fun creative videos or puppets or however you might remember the story being told. Now we get into sort of the wacky vision part of Daniel. So the last few chapters go beyond the story of what happened to Daniel and his friends, and now we look at these visions that Daniel had, that God gave him. Pictures of God's presence with his people in the midst of their hardships. So we're in Daniel 7 this morning. I'd invite you to turn there. We're going to walk our way through much of the chapter, although we're going to bounce around a little bit, and it would probably help you if you can have the text in front of you in one way or another as we do that. So we get into this interesting vision that Daniel had, and as we do, you may wonder what it is that Daniel ate before bed to give him this kind of a dream. But, of course, it's a vision from God. And the thing to remember as we read and as we reflect is that this was a vision that was intended to offer hope. To offer, really, hope to people in the midst of hard times, to God's people, as they faced hardship under the oppression of empires like Babylon. So we pick up the story, verse 1, Daniel chapter 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dreams. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being. And the mind of a human was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back, it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the 1st horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being, and a mouth that spoke boastfully." We'll pause our reading there for a moment. How do your dreams compare to this one? Had any dreams like that? I can remember as a child having a dream about a blob monster. It was going to devour my family, friends, house, my stuff. And, you know, you have dreams like that, and now you look back and you think, well, how silly. But in the moment, I mean, they can be kind of intense. I mean, when you're dreaming, it seems real, no matter how crazy it is when you're awake. When you're in the midst of it, it's a scary thing, and we're going to come back and finish Daniel's dream in a moment, but I want to think a little bit about how he responded, and then we'll start to get into the meaning of it. Verse 15 tells us how Daniel responds. It says, "I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me." So, I mean, he's a little bit afraid. He's troubled by what he's seeing. And so verse 16 tells us that he was not left to wonder. It says, "I approached one of those standing there and asked him the meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things." So Daniel gets a benefit that most of us don't get when we have a wild dream, and that is an interpretation. Because this isn't just a random dream. This is a message from God. And so he gets this interpretation. And it begins in verse 17. "The 4 great beasts are 4 kings that will rise from the earth." Now, if you have been reading through the book of Daniel with us, if you were here a month or so ago, this idea of a dream representing kings or representing kingdoms of the earth will not be a foreign one to you. Back in chapter 2, we had a statue made of various kinds of metals representing kings and kingdoms. Now we have these fearsome beasts. Well, with hindsight, commentators like to go back and say, so, what did these beasts represent? So, the angel says it's 4 kings, it's kings or the kingdoms that they lead. And Daniel didn't have this benefit, but commentators can go back and they can say, what might that they have been? And so, of course, scholars like to do that. And so, I'll just walk you through briefly what commentators tend to say about these 4 beasts. The first one, there's generally a lot of agreement on. The lion with wings. It seems like that is Babylon. So that is the beast, the empire that took Daniel and his friends away. And we could get into symbolism of the various parts of it. We're not going to do that. But suffice it to say that this beast looked powerful. I mean, it's a lion and it's got an eagle's wings. But in the dream, the wings are plucked. And so, as powerful as Babylon looked, they were as frail as humanity is. And so their time came and went. Then we have a ravenous bear that's next. And some commentators say, well, that's the empire of Media. Or some say, well, it's Media and it's Persia, and they together eventually became the Medo-Persian Empire. And they were known for their slow, crushing armies that could just overwhelm their opponents with their size and strength, kind of like a bear. And so Media or Media Persia together, that's typically who they think the bear is. Then we get to this strange leopard. Call it Death Leopard if you like to. I don't know. It's this leopard with four wings and four heads. Well, those that say the bear is Media typically say that the leopard must be Persia. If you think Medo-Persia is the bear, then, and this is the more common interpretation, then this leopard is probably the Greek Empire under Alexander the Great. You know, a leopard is known for being swift, and it's smart, and Alexander swiftly conquered the world. He was a military strategist like no other. And some would say that the fours, the wings and the heads, represent the four kind of kingdoms that Alexander's empire broke up into after his death. And then we have the fourth beast. And this is the one that seemed to most get Daniel's attention. The Bible Project co-founder Tim Mackey calls this the super mega beast. It doesn't really track with an animal. But in verse 23, we get an explanation of that. He gave me this explanation. The fourth beast is a fourth kingdom that will appear on earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The ten horns are ten kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, and that's the little horn. Different from the earlier ones, he will subdue three kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his holy people and try to change the set times and the laws. The holy people will be delivered into his hands for a time, times, and half a time. So, what is this beast? Well, scholars diverge on who this beast could be as they read the text. It could be anyone from the Greek Empire under Alexander to one of its offshoots. In particular, the Syrians were one of those four kingdoms that came from Alexander. Could be the Roman Empire, which was an empire like no other. Some say it's even maybe a future power, a future empire that the world hasn't yet seen. Maybe even the last human kingdom that will reach the apex of evil and rebellion against God. So, these are the beasts. And we've got different interpretations of what the beasts are. What do we do with that? What do we do with these different, I mean, which one is the right one? And the answer to that I would offer to you is it matters very little what the right answer is. It matters very little which beast is what kingdom or king. And that's often the way it is with biblical prophecy. You know, kind of the foretelling prophecy. I mean, you know, we want to study it and pore over it, and we want to know, like, what is this, and when is it going to be fulfilled, and what is it going to look like? More often than giving us a picture of the future that we're supposed to, you know, put together into some kind of framework, when the prophets are giving us messages, they're less concerned about the details, more concerned about a certain pattern and a promise that God is offering. What is the pattern? Well, the pattern is, here in Daniel 7, it's the pattern of world empires and kingdoms and nations. And nearly every nation, empire, kingdom succumbs to the temptation to be about conquest and to be about control and to be about consumption. Their focus almost always becomes on their own elevation, even at the expense of others. no matter how many people they have to mangle or how much misery they have to inflict along the way. That's the pattern. And just about every earthly kingdom, in some form or another, follows that pattern. Now, does that mean that every earthly kingdom is equally bad? No. Certainly not. But sometimes we can look at earthly nations, kingdoms, and empires and say, this one is good, and this one is bad. And we look at it in very black and white terms. And what the prophets would say to us is, I mean, the way that we tend to think of it as all good and all bad is not the way it is. I mean, all earthly kingdoms made up of flawed, sinful people are inherently bad. And there are degrees of badness. I mean, some are certainly worse than others, but they all are bad. They all end up going the same direction. They all become beasts. So, Daniel has this image of beasts. We look at kingdoms of the world, and they all, sooner or later, become beasts. You remember when I said a little bit ago that this vision is a vision of hope? Isn't this hopeful? Well, I would offer you this important observation. When we talk about hope, and that is true hope does not trivialize the horrors of evil. We've got to recognize that. I mean, if hope sort of glosses over the terrible things in the world and says, well, they're really not that bad, that is not true hope. God's people did suffer in Bible times. God's people do suffer. Christians have suffered. It's just a fact. We go through hard things. Daniel and company had suffered. The Jewish people would suffer. Followers of Jesus today around the world, they suffer. And chapter 8, which we're not going to delve into, actually highlights one particular time, about 160 years before the time of Jesus, where God's people, the Jewish people at the time, suffered terribly under King Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who has been called the Hitler of the Old Testament. Murdered, tortured people, tried to stamp out Judaism altogether. Hope does not minimize the bad. Bad things have happened. They do happen. They will happen. It's the way it is. And yet there can be hope in the midst of it. So where do we find that hope? Well, we need to go back to the part of the vision that we jumped over. So in verse 8, we had the super mega beast with its boastful little horn. And you might expect that after that big setup that, I mean, we're going to read about a whole lot of terrible things that this beast does. But in verse 9, the scene suddenly changes. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow, the hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were open. So we have this new character, the Ancient of Days. And doesn't take necessarily a Bible scholar to guess who that is, right? This is the one true God seated on his throne. He's the Ancient of Days. Now, essentially what that means is he's old. But understand in the mindset of the people that would have heard these words, to Daniel's way of thinking, the fact that he's ancient, that he's old, doesn't mean he's frail and senile. It means that he's grand and dignified. You know, parents sometimes say, I won't ask for a show of hands, but some of you said this, you know, I wasn't born yesterday, right? I mean, you're saying to your kids, if you say that, What you're saying is, you know, I've been around. You can't pull one over on me. Well, if parents say I wasn't born yesterday, the Ancient of Days says I wasn't born. And so there's no pulling anything over on him. Nothing will get by him. You will never catch him off guard. You'll never run a scam that he's never seen. You know, human kings and kingdoms can become frantic. And it seems like they usually are frantic about some economic or diplomatic or military crisis. But the Ancient of Days is never surprised, never in a panic, never caught off guard. And anyway, his throne. Did you notice his throne with the flaming wheels? Oh, Tim Mackey calls it the Godmobile. No, God's hot rod here. It can take him anywhere he needs to be in the thick of the action. Well, what we see here is a picture of the greatness of God. And when you're looking for hope in hard times, there it is. It's the greatness of our God. Nothing can stop him. Nothing can fool him. Nothing can stand in his way. Well, we meet one more character in this vision in verse 13. In my vision at night, Daniel says, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So we have what Daniel calls one like a son of man. What does that mean? Well, basically, it just means a human being. I mean, someone who looked like the son of a man and woman. Looks human, and yet we see that this one is human, but is also more than that. Coming with the clouds, which implies divinity. Given authority, glory, and sovereign power, being worshipped. He has a kingdom. So he's royalty. And so we have the Ancient of Days, and we have one like a son of man. And in between the two of them, we have the resolution of the beasts. And again, you might expect this big, crazy battle. Well, verse 11 says, then I continued to watch because of the boastful words that smallest horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. So just like that, I mean, these terrible beasts that had Daniel so fearful are dispatched. We have the greatness of the Ancient of Days to give us hope. But we also have something else. We also have not just the greatness of our God, but we have the goodness of our God to give us hope. Like many families do, our family usually has a prayer at mealtime when we sit down together for the evening meal. And sometimes it's a little spontaneous prayer, but often we like to do a kind of a recitation of some little prayer. And so one that we use sometimes is one that I suspect some of you have used. You know the one, God is great, and God is good, and we thank him for our food. By his hands we all are fed. Give us, Lord, our daily bread. Now, it bothers me a little bit that good and food don't rhyme. But, you know, if you pray it with an Irish accent, it's good and food, and then it rhymes. So try that. God is great, and God is good. It's important that we have those two together. Because God could be great, you know, awesome, sovereign, powerful, and he could be terrifying. But he is also good. I mean, and in the one like a son of man here in Daniel 7, we see the goodness of God. We see someone who is human who can relate to us. And we see one who is ready to do what is right and just and to put the arrogant in their place. And, you know, after this big buildup of terrible beasts, just like that, can make it all right. And that is a source of hope for us. Yes, things can be hard. And Daniel's vision was scary in the moment. But we have the picture of the greatness and the goodness of God to give us hope. And you see that toward the end. Verse 21 tells us that this little horn was waging war against the holy people and defeating them. Verse 25 says they were even delivered into his hands for a time, times, and half a time. What does that mean? Well, it could be 3.5 years. Time is one, times is two, and half a time. It could be 3.5 years. More specifically, just read it as for a defined period of time. They have their power. They have their way. Verse 26, but the court will sit and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom and all rulers will worship and obey him. So we didn't talk about the identity of that one like a son of man, did we? I mean, we talk about the Ancient of Days, that's God on his throne. What about this one like a son of man? Now, even if you're not a church person, you probably can make, you know, with 98% accuracy a guess as to who that one like a son of man is. Well, you know, that phrase, son of man, was used in the New Testament hundreds of years later. In the Gospels, the accounts of Jesus, it was used some 80 times by Jesus himself. And you know who he was referring to? Of course you do. He's referring to himself. One of the most prominent places we can find this is in Matthew 26. As Jesus is standing trial before the Jewish religious leaders. And there in Matthew 26, it says, those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. And it tells us they were looking for evidence of some kind. False, true, it didn't matter. But looking for some kind of evidence to charge him and to have him executed. And eventually they found it. But Matthew says Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. You have said so, Jesus replied. But I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. Now, Jesus doesn't call himself the Son of Man there, does he? But he's speaking to this crowd of Bible scholars, and they know exactly what he is saying. They know that he is referring to Daniel 7 when he talks about the Son of Man coming on the clouds. They know. I mean, it's like if you're at a Star Wars convention and you see someone running around in a black helmet that makes heavy breathing noises with a green lightsaber. Does that person have to announce who they are? Of course not, because everyone there knows. And everyone in that room knew who Jesus was talking about. Who's the Son of Man? He is. But here's the implication. If he's the Son of Man, then who are they? They're beasts. They're the beasts. And Jesus is essentially saying, You may kill me like the worst beast in the world. But at the end of the day, I will be vindicated, I will be exalted, and you will be judged for what you are doing. We read Daniel 7 and we want to know, you know, who are all these people and what does all of this mean precisely? You know, from Jesus' point of view, you know, even the Jewish religious leaders could be beasts. And from Jesus' point of view, even you and I can be beasts. You know, we can be driven by instincts and desires and appetites like a beast. And we all do become beasts at times, if you're honest. I mean, that's the foundational problem of humanity. We become beasts, giving into our worst impulses when we reject God's authority over us. We've all got a little beast inside. It comes out sometimes. And when you get a whole kingdom of beasts together, look out. But you know, we have cause for hope. Even when we face the beasts out there, even when I face the beast in here, and you do too, there's reason for hope. You know, Jesus became like us, a son of man, so that we could become like him. When the beast in us is put to death, we can become his holy people. What Daniel describes is the inheritors of his kingdom who will be invited to reign with him. And to kill the beast, he died himself to put to death the beast. Not the beast within him, but the beasts within us. And then he rose again to life so that we could be truly human as God intended. Well, we come this morning as we close to the table of communion. And that's where we remember what the beast did to him. With simple elements of bread and juice, we see how the beast tore his flesh, shed his blood. And if you've asked God to put to death the beast in you, then we welcome you to participate. You're going to be served in your seats this morning. I'm going to invite the servers to come to the tables now. You'll be served in your seats, and I'd encourage you to let either your server or the person next to you hold the tray so that you can take your elements as the trays come to you. Hold the bread and the cup, and we'll eat and drink together at the end. And I'd invite you, as you're served, to allow the Holy Spirit to bring to mind any recent moments or times where you have been less than the human that God called you to be. Bring that to him, confess and rejoice that beast has died with Jesus. You may receive your elements.